Abby, is Bull really bleeding? I asked. She nodded, causing Bull to crank up the volume. It was pitiful to hear. Jasper Jr. started throttling me by the shoulders. Make her quit, Underwood! Make her stop! One condition, I said. You guys let her go free. Jasper Jr. sneered his famous sneer. How about this for a condition, dork brain? Your sister quits chewing on Bull, else I start pounding your head with a ripe coconut. Bull managed to calm himself long enough to offer his own opinion. The girl takes her teeth out of my ear, she walks. You got my promise, Underwood. Hey, no way, Jasper Jr. began to protest. You shut up, Bull snapped. He was looking at us with his thick neck bent toward the ground and his head positioned sideways to give Abby as much slack as possible. Considering the delicate situation, she seemed incredibly calm. I didn't see a single drop of blood, but there was no reason to inform Bull that he wasn't really bleeding to death. So, guys, do we have a deal or not? I asked. Deal, Bull grunted. Yeah, whatever, said Jasper Jr., spearing me with a bony elbow. All right, then, I said. Abby, you can let go now.
Nuh-uh,
she said through a mouthful of crinkled ear. Come on, let go of Bull.
Nuh-uh.
You want to catch some gross disease? He probably hasn't had a bath since Christmas, I said.
Even that didn't make her quit. I knew why, too. She didn't want to leave me out there alone with the two of them. Honest, I'll be okay, I said, which must have sounded incredibly lame. She knew I wasn't going to be okay. She knew they were going to stomp me into hamburger meat.
Nuh-uh,
my sister said emphatically. Abby, come on! There was no way I could let her stay in the woods. Jasper Jr. was a vicious punk who wouldn't think twice about beating up a girl half his size. Bull said, I think I'm going to hurl. Abby chomped down harder, and the noise that came out of Bull didn't sound human. Jasper jumped me again and put me in a headlock. Now listen, you little brat, he snapped at my sister. We're going to do this my way. I'll break your brother's neck if you don't spit out Bull's ear by the count of three. There was no response from Abby, but now I saw true fear in her eyes. My face must have looked like a tomato about to explode as hard as Jasper Jr. was clenching down on me. I couldn't tell my sister what to do next because I couldn't squeak out a word. One, said Jasper Jr. Abby hung on. Two. Abby wasn't budging. Two, Jasper Jr. barked again. I tried to wiggle free, but it was no use. Jasper Jr.'s forearm was locked tight against my throat, and it hurt to breathe. Everything in front of me started getting fuzzy and dark, and I figured I was about to pass out. The next words I heard were, Try 2½, shorty. The voice sounded too old and gravelly to be Jasper Jr., but I just assumed that my hearing was messed up because he'd squeezed all the oxygen out of my brain. Let him go, the voice said again, and it clearly wasn't speaking to Abby. It was speaking to Jasper Jr., who, to my complete surprise, immediately let go of me. I fell to the ground and stayed on all fours until I caught my breath. You all right, Noah? I lifted my eyes in bewilderment. The voice belonged to a lanky, long-armed man with woolly, silvery hair. A gleaming gold coin hung from a tarnished chain around his neck. His craggy face looked like a mahogany stump, and on one tan cheek was a scar in the shape of an M. Anybody could see that the guy was old and tough. Shirtless and barefoot, he leaned casually against the trunk of a tall pine. His weather-beaten cutoffs had been bleached gray by the sun, and a dirty red bandana was knotted around his right wrist. The curly hair on his bare chest was as shiny as the hair on his head. Jasper Jr. wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he knew that the stranger meant business. He was only joking around, he said timidly. That right? The old pirate smiled in a way that caused Jasper Jr. to go pale. Bull whimpered like a puppy, but said nothing. The stranger turned to my sister. Now it's your turn, Abby. How about you let loose of that boy? My sister's eyes got wide at the sound of her name. She released her grip on Bull's ear, stepped back, and began spitting vigorously into the bushes. Bull straightened up and pressed a fist to his throbbing ear, trying to staunch the invisible bleeding. Who are you? I asked the old man. How do you know our names? He brushed past me and went up to Jasper Jr., who looked like he desperately needed a bathroom. You ever bother these two kids again, the old man warned him, and you'll dearly regret it. Comprende? Jasper Jr. nodded shakily. Bull was actually an inch or so taller than the pirate, but it didn't help him. The guy walked over and got square in his face. Pretty summer day. you can't think of anything better to do than hassle some helpless little girl? That's flat-out pathetic, son.
Helpless? She nearly took off my ear!
I'd say you got off lucky, the stranger said with a smile. He winked at Abby and me and jerked a thumb over one shoulder. Y'all run on home. Hurry up now.
Who are you? My sister asked.
Nobody, and that's the truth. He wasn't kidding around. Now get going, both of you, he said. Me and the boys are going to finish our chat.
Abby and I quickly retrieved our bicycles and took off. As soon as we were out of the trees, we started pedaling for home as fast as we could.
You ever seen that guy before? Abby asked breathlessly.
I don't think so.
Then how do you know who we were? Has he been spying on us or something? He looked kind of dangerous, Noah. Do you think he's dangerous?
Abby, I honestly don't know.
Maybe I should have been creeped out by the strange old pirate, but I wasn't. For some reason, I believed everything he'd said in the woods. Except the part about him being nobody.
It was an hour before dark when we got out to the islands called the Cow Pens. They got that name because Indians supposedly kept sea cows penned up there a long time ago. Dad tossed the anchor into a deep hole about 200 yards from the main channel. The tropical rescue towboat was much bigger than Dad's bonefish skiff, so there was plenty of room for Mom to ride along. She'd said yes, too, which was a nice surprise. She sat on the bow with her back to the sun and snapped pictures of us fishing. Right away, I got a couple of decent mangrove snappers, and Dad caught a fat keeper grouper. My sister reeled in a puffer fish that blew itself up into a spiny balloon. She said it looked just like her fourth-grade teacher. Of course, Abby and I didn't mention what had happened that afternoon on the way home from Shelley's trailer. Dad would have taken off after Jasper Jr., and Mom would have gone to the police to tell them about the strange old man. Besides, my father liked things quiet and peaceful when he was out on the water. He didn't go for too much talking. He said it was disrespectful to nature. After a while, we put away our fishing rods and sat down to wait for the sunset. The sky to the west was mostly clear, except for a few wispy clouds and a long foamy contrail from a big military jet. Dad took a seat up front next to Mom, who handed the camera to Abby. I dangled my legs off the starboard gunwale, where rescue was painted in bright orange lettering. A flock of pelicans floated over us in the shape of a V and kept on flying straight toward the Great Gulf of Mexico. A light breeze was blowing from the southeast, rocking the boat just enough to make us a little drowsy. Abby nudged me and cut her eyes toward our parents, who were actually holding hands. Everything felt so good and so right, I had this feeling we'd actually get to see the green flash. The evening was perfect for it. Gradually, the sun changed from gold to blazing pink and seemed to turn liquid as it dimpled the horizon. None of us said a word because we didn't want the moment to end. People who've never seen a sunset at sea would be blown away. Time seems to slow down until finally that huge blazing ball looks like it's just hanging there, balanced on the far edge of the earth. In reality, though, it's dropping fast. As the last rosy crescent melted into the gulf, I felt myself leaning forward, squinting hopefully at the skyline. Then the sun was gone, leaving a pale lemon emptiness. I glanced over at Abby, who was putting the camera away. She smiled and shrugged.
Wow, that was gorgeous, my mother whispered.
Yeah, said Abby, but no green flash. Maybe next time, my father said, as he always did.
I turned my gaze back to the horizon and held it there, even as the rim of pink faded to darkness. I heard Dad hauling in the anchor and Mom zipping up her windbreaker and Abby asking if she could steer back to the dock. But still, I couldn't take my eyes off the sky. 14. $57.16. That's all Abby and I could scrounge up, and 51 bucks of it was hers. I would have had more if I hadn't bought new skateboard trucks the first week of vacation.
You think it's going to buy enough? Abby asked on the way to the store.
It'll have to, I said.
I didn't know the exact size of the Coral Queen's holding tank, but I guessed it carried a couple hundred gallons of waste. I also didn't know how much dye we could get for $57.16.
Abby led me to the aisle where the food coloring was displayed. Blue won't work, right?
No, that wouldn't show up, I agreed, scanning the shelves.
What do they use this stuff for anyway?
Frosting, desserts, all kinds of goodies.
Do they make an orange?
No, but here's a fuchsia, Abby said.
What?
That's how it's pronounced, Noah. Fuchsia.
I had no idea what fuchsia was, but it sounded like something you wouldn't want to step in. It's a hot reddish purple, Abby explained. Perfect for Operation Royal Flush. That was the code name for our secret mission to nail Dusty Muehlman. We decided to use food coloring gel instead of laundry dye, because the gel wasn't made with chemicals that would harm the sea life. Even better, it was highly concentrated, which meant that a small amount would dye a lot of poopy water. The plastic bottles were little, though, holding only an ounce. There was only one container of fuchsia on the shelf, so we asked a stock boy to go find more. How many you want? He asked. Bring us all you've got, I said. When we got to the cash register, the checkout lady gave us the skunk eye as she tallied up the total. What in the world, she said, arching an eyebrow, would you kids be doing with 34 bottles of food coloring? Abby smiled sweetly. We're baking a birthday cake, she said. Oh, is that right? A very big birthday cake, my sister added. And a very purple one, I see, the checkout lady said, handing us the bag of bottles. On the way home, I kept looking behind us to see if we were being followed by the old pirate geezer. I couldn't stop wondering who he was and how he knew us. Abby said he was probably a gnarly old mate from one of the sport fishing boats, or maybe a bridge person who'd seen us around the island and overheard us calling each other by name. Whoever he was, I kept my eyes peeled. As we turned the corner of our street, someone called out to us. It was Bull, of all people, standing in front of the house. He waved as we rode up, though Abby and I were too suspicious to wave back. I hopped off my bike and asked, "What's up?" Bull seemed edgy and uncomfortable. I could see Abby's teeth marks on his left ear, which was still puffy and crinkled. He cleared his throat about 5 times before he finally spoke.
I just came over to say I was sorry, he said. Real sorry.
I set the grocery bag full of dye bottles on the sidewalk. My sister stood behind me and said, "Is this some kind of sick joke?"
"No way." Bull shook his head forcefully. "I'm righteously sorry. For everything, dude."
He was looking straight at me.
"All the times me and Jasper hassled you? It was wrong, okay? Bogus and wrong."
"What's going on, Bull?"
"Nothing! Why you ask me that?"
"Because all of a sudden you're Mr. Huggy Bear. It's very weird."
"Come on, Underwood. Can't a dude say he's sorry and be real? What's the problem?"
Bull was getting frustrated, and I didn't want to push him too far. "Okay, we're cool," I said. "You say you're sorry, I believe you."
"Excellent."
"Well, I don't believe you," Abby cut in. "Either you're faking it or you've had a total personality transplant." Bull's long, dull face pinched in confusion.
"What do you mean by that? What kind of transplant, you say?"
"Never mind," I said. "What about Jasper Jr.?"
"Oh, yeah, I almost forgot. He's sorry, too."
"Really? Then where is he?" Bull hitched his shoulders. Dark half-moons of sweat had appeared in the armpits of his faded Harley-Davidson t-shirt.
"He couldn't come, but he wanted me to tell you it won't never happen again," Bull said. "We won't beat up on you no more."
"That's nice. Next you'll be sending me flowers." Naturally, Bull didn't catch on that I was being sarcastic. "I'd really like to hear Jasper Jr.'s apology in person," I said. "Fat chance," mumbled my sister. She picked up the grocery bag and lugged it inside the house. Bull just stood there, sweating through his shirt and staring down at his enormous bare feet. It sounds strange, but I felt sort of sorry for the guy. He'd quit school and left the Keys to be a big baseball star, but here he was, back on the rock, bagging groceries and hanging out with losers like Jasper Jr.
"Come on, man. Tell the truth," I said, though it wasn't in Bull's nature. He looked up slowly.
"Underwood, who's that freaky old man? The guy in the woods?"
"Just a friend," I said, thinking a friend and total stranger.
"Where'd he get that wicked bad scar on his face?"
"Eh, he doesn't talk about it," I said, hoping that Bull would think I was tight with the pirate guy.
"Thing is," Bull said, "he told me and Jasper to, well..."
"What?"
"He told us to tell you we was sorry for what we done to you and your little sister. He was real clear on that," Bull said. "But when it come time, Jasper just flat out wouldn't do it. He said he didn't care what some crazy old bush rat told him."
"What else did the old man in the woods say?" I asked.
Bull turned and checked over his shoulder, his eyes moving up and down the street.
"He said not to screw up again, He said he'll be hanging close and don't never forget it.
Bull's visit finally made sense. He'd come to apologize because he was terrified not to.
You'll tell him, won't you, Underwood? Tell him I stopped over and said I was sorry? When you see him again, I mean.
Sure, Bull. When I see him again. Though I wondered if I ever would. After lunch, my sister and I headed for Shelley's place to deliver the food dye and review our plan. Even though she came to the door wearing the nappy pink robe and carrying a plastic razor, we could tell that she was in better shape than the day before. She waved us inside and cheerfully resumed shaving her legs at the kitchen sink, a procedure I'd never witnessed so up close and personal. The way Shelley did it wasn't quite as glamorous as in the TV commercials. Whenever she nicked herself, she'd cuss like a biker and wipe away the blood with her pinky. Abby watched in fascination, but I felt kind of weird, so I turned away and pretended to be enchanted by the scummy aquarium. I could hear the razor blades scraping across Shelley's skin as she said, "So, we're good to go?" "What about Billy Babcock?" I asked. "Don't worry, I got that all figured out." But I was worried. If Billy was at the Coast Guard station when the sewage spill was reported, he'd tip off Dusty Muehlman right away. It wouldn't take long for Dusty's crew to unhitch the Coral Queen and take her offshore, where they could flush the holding tank until there was no trace of our dye, and no way to connect Dusty to the crime. "Ever since he heard Lice was gone, Billy's been spending lots of time at my bar," Shelley said, "leaving $10 tips on $10 tabs. "Did he ask you out?" Abby said. "Only about two or three times a night." Shelley tossed the plastic razor into a trash basket, poured herself a cup of coffee, and sat down at the dinette. "I'll handle Billy Babcock," she said with a confident smile. "Now let me see what you got." Abby gave her the grocery bag containing the bottles of coloring gel. Shelley peeked inside and said, "Those are puny little suckers. Sure that'll do the job?" "Well, it's concentrated," I started to explain. "I know it's concentrated, Noah. I've baked a few treats in my time." Abby told her that we'd bought out the store. 34 bottles. Is that okay?" "No problem," Shelley said. "I've got a purse big enough to carry a Honda Civic." She held up one of the bottles. "Ever used this stuff before?" Abby and I shook our heads. "Well, it doesn't pour out like water. It's more gooey, like sunblock, so you've really got to squeeze," Shelley said, demonstrating on a capped container. 34 bottles, that's going to take some time." I hadn't thought about that when we'd picked out the gel. Neither had Abby. "See, it's just me working solo behind the bar," said Shelley. "And Dusty doesn't like his customers to go thirsty. I only get 2 15-minute potty breaks every night, which ain't nearly enough time to flush all this stuff." "Does that mean you can't help us?" I asked. "Now don't get your shorts in a knot," she said. "I'll tell Dusty I got sick off the shrimp salad. What's he gonna do, make me go in a bucket?" "Isn't there a head near the bar?" I asked. Abby poked me. "A what?" "A toilet," I explained. "On ships, they're called heads. Shelley told us that the Coral Queen had 3 sets, one fore, one aft, and one up in the wheelhouse, which is out of the question. It's only for the casino manager and the crew." "But aren't you part of the crew?" Abby said. "No, sweetie, I'm a bartender. They make me tinkle with the civilians." The more I heard, the more worried I got. The longer that Shelley was away from the bar, the greater the risk that Dusty or one of his goons would go searching for her. Other things could go wrong, too. What if the toilet she was using malfunctioned or got clogged? I decided on a slight change of plan. "You'll need some backup on board," I said. "I'll take half the dye and flush it from a different head." Shelley tossed her head. "Oh, no, you don't, James Bond Jr. It's too hairy." "Just find me a place to hide. There's got to be somewhere safe." "Hello, what about me?" Abby interjected. Together, Shelley and I turned and said, "No way." "You don't bring me along, I'll rat you out to Dad and Mom," my sister declared. "I swear to God, Noah." She wasn't joking, either. The veins in her scrawny neck were popping out, she was so ticked off. "You couldn't do this without me," she said. "If it wasn't for my $51, you wouldn't have enough dye to color a bird bath." I couldn't argue with that. "This is getting way too complicated," Shelley said, slurping at her coffee. "Look, we're only going to get one chance at Dusty," I said, "so we'd better do it right." Shelley shot me a doubtful look. "If you two brats get caught, we won't," Abby cut in. "But if you do, we'll never mention your name," I said.
That's a promise. Double promise, said Abby. Shelley sighed.
I must be out of my mind.
It was almost 5:30 when Mr. Shine dropped off my parents at the house. They'd spent the afternoon at the courthouse, working out the final settlement of the Coral Queen case. Dusty Muehlman had agreed not to prosecute my father for scuttling the casino boat, and in exchange, Dad had promised to pay back Dusty's insurance company for the cost of refloating the thing, cleaning it up, and fixing the diesels. The bill must have been super expensive because the judge gave my father 5 whole years to pay it off. He also made Dad swear not to say anything bad about Dusty on TV, in the newspapers, or anywhere in public. So much for the First Amendment, my father griped as we sat down to dinner. Might as well walk around with a cork in my mouth. The important thing is, it's over, Mom said. Now maybe our lives can get back to normal. I didn't dare look at Abby for fear of cluing my mother that we were up to something. Dad was too bummed out to notice.
Everybody in the county thinks I'm crazy anyway, he said sourly.
Who cares what everybody thinks, I said. And who cares if you're crazy, Abby piped up, as long as it's a good crazy. She meant that as a compliment, and my father seemed to take it that way.
It's unholy what Dusty is doing. A crime against nature, Dad went on.
You know what he deserves? He deserves to be...
Pain, that's enough, my mother said sternly. Someday he'll get exactly what he deserves. What goes around comes around.
Dad snorted.
If only.
Mom's right, Abby said. Dusty can't get away with this stuff forever.
My sister played it perfectly straight. She's a slick little actress.
Someday they're gonna bust him cold. Don't worry, she said.
Dad looked at her fondly and said, Let's hope you're right. But we could tell he didn't believe that Dusty Muehlman would ever be caught.
My mother said, Noah, we need you to stay home with Abby tomorrow night.
What for? I tried to sound annoyed, but I was really excited. This was the golden chance that my sister and I needed.
Your dad and I are going out for dinner and a movie, Mom said.
Woohoo! A hot date, teased Abby.
We're celebrating your father's new job.
Oh, yeah, Dad said dryly. My exciting new career, towing numbskull tourists off the Bonefish Flats.
Well, doesn't it beat driving a cab, I asked.
True enough, he admitted.
I want you both in bed by 11, not a minute later, Mom told us. You hear me?
Absolutely, I said. Double absolutely, said Abby. 11 sharp. Neither of us could look Mom in the eye. It felt lousy lying to her, but honestly, we had no choice. Not if we hoped to catch Dusty Muehlman red-handed.
Or... fuchsia-handed, to be exact.
15.
Mom and Dad left on their hot date at exactly 6:45. The Coral Queen opened for business at 8, so Abby and I didn't have a moment to spare. We rode our bikes to Rado's house and jumped the wooden fence, which turned out to be a real bad idea. Rado and his parents were still vacationing in Colorado, which I knew, but they'd left Godzilla at home in the backyard. Which I didn't know. Godzilla isn't the world's smartest dog, but he's the biggest I've ever seen. Rado says he's part Rottweiler, part Newfoundland, and part grizzly bear. He easily outweighed my sister and me put together, and he wasn't all that happy to see us.
Good dog, I said, in the calmest voice I could fake.
Nice try, whispered Abby, but we're still gonna die. Godzilla had cornered us against the fence, and we didn't dare make a move. I was hoping the beast remembered me, although it probably wouldn't matter if the neighbors had forgotten to feed him. Abby would be the appetizer, and I'd be the main course.
Here, boy,
I said, holding out my right hand.
Are you crazy?
Abby hissed.
Dogs never forget the smell of a person they've met.
Says who?
Says the Animal Planet, that's who. They did a whole show on dogs' noses, I said.
Yeah, well, obviously you missed the episode on dogs' teeth.
But Godzilla didn't chomp off my hand. He sniffed it suspiciously and nudged it with his moist snout. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't shaking.
Noah, his tail's not wagging, Abby said under her breath.
Thanks for the bulletin. If he bites you, I'm biting him.
Easy, girl, I said.
They say you can look into a dog's eyes and know whether he's friendly or not. Unfortunately, I couldn't see Godzilla's eyes because they were hidden beneath thick tangles of black Newfoundland hair. A pearly string of drool hung from his mouth, which meant he was either hot or hungry, or possibly both. With my left hand, I fished into my pants and took out a green apple that I brought along for a snack.
Abby grunted.
Noah, you've got to be kidding. Dogs don't eat fruit.
It's the best I can do unless you've got a sirloin steak in your backpack. I held out the apple and said,
Here, boy.
Yum. Godzilla cocked his anchor-sized head and let out a snort. It's a Granny Smith, I said, as if he actually understood.
Go on and try it. It tastes good.
Yeah, if you're a squirrel, my sister muttered.
But to our total amazement, the huge dog opened his huge jaws and clamped down his huge fangs on the apple, which he firmly tugged from my trembling hand.
As Godzilla trotted away with his prize, I said to Abby, Check out his tail. It was wagging cheerfully. Abby and I hurried toward the canal, where Rado kept a blue dinghy tied to the seawall. His father had salvaged a little boat off a scuttled motor yacht and patched up the fiberglass as good as new. It wasn't more than 10 feet long, but it was dry and sturdy, with high sides and a deep hull. Rado, Tom, and I often took it out on calm days to snorkel around the bridges. When we climbed into the dinghy, I tossed Abby one of the life vests. She insisted she didn't need it, but I told her we weren't going anywhere until she put it on. Next, I gave her a quick lesson on cranking the outboard motor. It was an ancient little Evinrude that could be stubborn before it warmed up. I showed Abby how to use both hands to yank the starter cord, which was tricky. If you didn't let go in time, the pullback could wrench you off balance and spin you overboard. After a half dozen hard tugs, the motor spluttered to life in a burp of purple smoke. Rado's dad always made sure the gas can was full, but I checked anyway, just in case. Getting stranded would be a total disaster. My sister moved to the front of the dinghy and untied the bow rope. I unhitched the ropes and shoved off. Ready? I asked her. Absolutely, she said, and flashed me a double thumbs up. As we cruised slowly toward the mouth of the canal, I glanced back and saw Godzilla watching us from the seawall. He barked once, but the noise was muffled by the juicy green apple still clenched in his jaws. Growing up near the ocean, you learn about some strange superstitions. For instance, lots of fishing captains won't let you bring a ripe banana on board because they believe it's bad luck. Nobody knows how that one got started, but Dad told me it's been around the docks since before Grandpa Bobby's time. Another superstition is that dolphins bring good luck, so I was glad to spot a school of them herding bait fish as Abby and I motored up the shoreline. By counting the dorsal fins, we figured out there were 6 grown-up dolphins and 1 baby, and they were having a blast, zipping in frothy circles, tossing mullets high in the air. I don't know if they're really a good omen, but seeing wild dolphins always makes me feel better. Any other time, I would have stopped the boat to watch them play, but Abby and I were in a hurry. It stays light pretty late during the summer, so it was a clear ride to Dusty Muleman's marina. By the time we reached the channel markers, the waves had gotten choppy. I nosed the dinghy into some mangroves, cut the engine, and hopped out, balancing in my skateboard shoes on slick, rubbery roots. My sister dug through her backpack and took out a bottle of Gatorade, some bug spray, a lemony Snicket book, and a flashlight. Then she handed the backpack to me. "Sure you're okay with this?" I asked. "I'll be gone a while."
"Oh, give me a break," Abby said. "Of course I'm okay."
"Stay right here until you hear me yell, Geronimo. Then you know what to do."
"Why Geronimo?" she asked.
"Because I saw somebody do that in a movie once."
"What the heck does it mean?"
"It means hurry up and rescue me before I get my butt kicked by Dusty's big ugly goon," I said. "No more questions, okay? Keep out of sight, and I'll see you later." As I began working my way toward the docks, I heard Abby call out, "Be careful, Noah!" I waved over my shoulder, but I didn't look back. By the time I broke free of the mangroves, my shoes were soaking wet, and my shins were scraped from the barnacle-covered roots. Crouching low, I dashed across a clearing and ducked behind Dusty Muleman's ticket shed. There, on the ground, side by side, were the 2 large crates that Shelley had told me to look for. Peeking around a corner of the shack, I saw that the parking area was filling up with cars. Customers were already lined up to board the Coral Queen. There weren't any kids in the crowd because kids weren't allowed on the casino boat. That's why I had to be so careful. Using the sharp edge of a rock, I pried the lid off the first wooden crate. It was full of liquor bottles, rum from Haiti, according to the labels. Silently, I replaced the cover and moved to the other crate. As Shelley had promised, it was empty. I squeezed inside and dragged the heavy lid back into place. In order to fit, I had to lie flat and pull my knees to my chest. Abby's backpack, stuffed with containers of food dye, served as a lumpy pillow under my head.
I was so cramped it felt like I was hiding in one of those magician's boxes, pretending to be disappeared. The crate was dark and musty inside. At first, I was afraid I couldn't breathe, but soon I felt whispers of air seeping under the lid. I took a few gulps, closed my eyes, and began to wait. Before long, I heard the scuff of footsteps, and then the low sounds of men talking. The first voice I didn't recognize, but the thick accent of the second was unmistakable. It was Dusty's bald gorilla, Luno. The men grunted as they hoisted the first crate and hauled it off to the Coral Queen. By the time they returned, my heart was thumping like a jackhammer. Luno lifted one end of my crate while his companion grabbed the other. I went rigid and held my breath. I could hear them swearing and complaining about the weight. With every step, the crate tipped and lurched and bounced. I knew I'd be dead meat if the lid fell off, so I dug my fingernails into the wooden slats to keep it in place. Finally, the goons set me down with a jolting thud, and I knew I was on the boat. Once they were gone, I seriously thought about kicking my way out of that miserable wooden tomb. I could have done it, no problem, except that I'd promised Shelley to stay put until she got there. So I waited some more, and waited, and waited. The Coral Queen was getting noisy as the customers piled aboard. Nobody else came near the crate, though, so I figured I must be in a storage area behind a wall or a door. Wherever it was, there was definitely no air conditioning. Before long, I was sweating like a horse, and my throat was as dry as sawdust. I wondered how much longer I could stand it inside that moldy old box. It seemed like I was cooped up for hours, but it probably wasn't even 20 minutes before Shelley tapped 3 times on the side. She helped me climb out and handed me a cold bottle of water. Nothing in my whole life had ever tasted so good. I hugged her, tangerine perfume and all. That's how grateful I was. She put a finger to her lips and motioned for me to follow. It was impossible not to notice that she was wearing those wild fishnet stockings and tippy high-heeled shoes that made her about 5 inches taller than normal. She led me along a dim corridor that opened onto one of the busy casino decks. The noise hit me like a roar, the slot machines clanging, people laughing and hooting, some lame calypso band mangling a Jimmy Buffett song. "There it is, Noah," Shelley pointed to a door. On it hung a hand-carved sign that spelled out the word mermaids. "Don't move," she told me, and promptly disappeared into the stall. Seconds later, the door cracked open, and Shelley's blonde head poked out. She looked around warily, then signaled for me to join her. Inside the ladies' restroom. So I did. The two of us could barely fit. "Where's the stuff?" she whispered. I patted Abby's backpack. The day before, Shelley and I had divided the stash of food coloring. 17 bottles for me, 17 for her. "You got the sign?" I asked. She smiled and held it up for me to see. A square piece of cardboard on which she had printed in capital letters with a jet black marker. "Out of order. Guaranteed privacy," she assured me. "But what about you?" I was worried that she wouldn't have a safe place to flush her supply of the dye. "There's another mermaid's john up front. I'll use that one for my potty breaks." "But what if somebody's already in there?" I asked. "Then I'll crash the mermen's." "The men's room? You serious?" Shelley shrugged. "Hey, who's gonna stop me?" She had a point. "I gotta get back to the bar," she said. "Billy Babcock's waiting on me all moony-eyed. Poor sap thinks he's in love." She gave my shoulder a friendly tweak. "Good luck, young Underwood." "You too, Shelley." I locked the door the instant it closed. As soon as I heard her tack up the out-of-order sign, I unzipped Abby's backpack and removed the dye bottles. The head on a boat is basically a glorified closet with barely enough room to sit and do your business. This one smelled like a mixture of stale beer, Clorox bleach, and Shelley's fruity perfume, but it was still less obnoxious than most public commodes. And as uncomfortable as it was way better than being sealed up inside a liquor crate. For a moment, I wondered what my father would have thought if he could see me there, locked in the mermaid's head on the Coral Queen. The parent part of him would have been mad for me sneaking aboard, while the nature-loving part of him would have been proud of me for trying to nail Dusty Muleman. Knowing Dad, he would have had one firm piece of advice. Don't get caught. When I opened the first bottle of food coloring, I saw that Shelley was right. The gel oozed out like molasses. Carefully, I squeezed the plastic container until every gooey purple drop landed in the toilet hole. Then I gave a good hard flush to make sure the dye went where it was supposed to go. Shelley had warned me that the stuff could get gummy pretty quick. If it stuck in the plumbing pipes, our plan would be ruined. There was only one way to check it out. I knelt down, pinched my nose, and peered into the nasty depths of the head. Not a speck of fuchsia could be seen. So far, so good. One bottle down, 16 to go. Time passes incredibly slowly when you're trapped in a restroom. Whenever I got ready to make a break, people would stop in loud groups outside the door, talking, laughing, singing along to the music. I was dying to get out of there, but I had to be patient. I had to wait for a lull. I kept thinking of Abby alone in Rado's dinghy, reading her book by flashlight. Even though there were no dangerous wild animals in the mangroves, I was afraid she might get spooked by some of the freaky night noises. If you've never heard two raccoons fighting before, you'd swear it was a chainsaw massacre. When I wasn't worrying about my sister, I was thinking about what else was happening on board the Coral Queen. With so much partying, the other toilets were probably getting flush nonstop. If Dusty Muleman pulled his usual trick, all that raw waste would be streaming out of the basin later. It made me mad, which was good. I needed to stay mad in order to do what I had to. Every 2 or 3 minutes, I looked at my watch, wondering why the hands weren't moving faster. Mom and Dad were probably still at dinner. Afterward, they were supposed to go to a late movie in Tavernier. That meant they'd be home around 12:30, so Abby and I had to be back at the house and in bed before then. The Coral Queen closed at midnight. If I waited until then to slip away, we'd have less than 30 minutes to run the dinghy back to Rado's dock, grab our bikes, and race home. I didn't like the odds because it was dark on the water and the dinghy was slow. I also didn't like the idea of 3 more hours in the ladies' room. I decided to make a run for it, crowds and all, and pray that nobody would try to catch me. Shelley had said that most of the regular customers were so heavy into the gambling that a rhinoceros could get loose on board and they wouldn't care. I hoped she was right. Quietly, I gathered up the empty dye bottles, the only evidence that could ever incriminate me, and stowed them in Abby's backpack. But as I reached out and unlocked the door, the metal handle began to jiggle violently. Somebody was trying to get into the head. I grabbed the handle with both hands and braced my shoes against the sink.
"Hey, open up," demanded a croaky female voice. "I gotta go."
Either she didn't see the out-of-order sign, or she was so desperate that it didn't matter. From outside came a heavy grunt, and the handle was nearly yanked from my grip. The door opened no more than 2 inches, but it was enough to give me a startling peek at the intruder. She looked about 85 in both age and weight, which wasn't what I expected. She was pulling so ferociously on the door that I wouldn't have been surprised to see a 300-pound sumo wrestler on the other side.
"You open up right this second," the old woman squawked. "I gotta go now."
She wore a shiny copper-colored wig that fit like a helmet. Her face was caked with powdery makeup, and her sparkly fake eyelashes were longer than a camel's. A cigarette dangled from parrotfish lips that were puffy and painted the color of sliced mangoes.
"Can't you read the sign?" I asked through the crack.
"What sign, Einstein?"
That's when I spotted the piece of cardboard between her feet on the scuffed floor. Shelley's tack must have come loose.
"Hey, you're not even a mermaid," the old woman snapped, spitting her cigarette. "Get out of that bathroom before I call security."
It took all my strength to pull the door shut.
"You little sicko!"
She let out a string of cuss words that would have put my grandma Janet into cardiac arrest.
"Go away," I pleaded. "This is an emergency."
"Emergency? I'll show you a damn emergency."
The parrotfish lady pounded at the flimsy door with her bony fists.
"My bladder's about to blow like Mount St. Helen. You hear me, young man?"
Now she was shouting like a maniac. I knew it wouldn't be long before a crew member came running to see what was wrong.
"Listen up, you brat," the woman said. "I'm gonna count to five, then I'm busting in. And you better not be sitting on that john when I do. You read me, Junior? It ain't gonna be pretty."
"Please don't," I said, but it was hopeless.
"One, two..."
There was no other choice. I stood up from the toilet, put on the backpack, and lowered one shoulder. When the nasty old buzzard barked,
"Five!"
I crashed out the door, ducked under her flailing twig-sized arms, and took off running. Nobody would have paid much attention if she hadn't started shrieking,
"Catch him! Catch that rotten little pervert!"
Luckily, I'm pretty fast and not real tall, so I was able to dodge and weave through the legs of the gamblers.
A few of them glanced up, and one or two actually made a lame grab for my shirt. Fortunately, most of them had been celebrating hard and were in no condition to chase after me. Shelley's eyes got as wide as saucers when I flew past the bar. A bleary, leathery-faced man, who I assumed was Billy Babcock, spun on his stool and exclaimed, "Is that a kid on the boat?" I headed topside. An angry yell rose from behind me, and I turned to see two humongous guys in hot pursuit. They looked seriously ticked off. Each wore a tight red T-shirt with the words "Event Staff" silk-screened across the front. Shelley had warned me about them, the bouncers. They bellowed at me to stop, but that wasn't going to happen. I scampered to the upper deck and ran straight for the bow. Reflected below in the glassy basin were the twinkling Christmassy lights of the Coral Queen. It was a long way down to the water, longer than I'd imagined. "Game's over," a voice said. I turned to face the bouncers, 400-odd pounds of meat and muscle. Panting from the chase, they wore cocky grins. They thought they had me cornered, but they were wrong. One of them beckoned with a beefy finger. "Let's go, boy." I kicked off my shoes and stuffed them into Abby's backpack. The other one spoke up. "Chill out, shrimp. Don't try anything stupid." After that shrimp remark, I couldn't resist messing with them. "If I fall overboard and drown," I said, "you guys are in deep trouble." "Yeah, right. My mom and dad'll sue Mr. Muleman for every cent he's got, so you'd better watch it." The bouncers looked at each other and their smiles faded. While they huddled to discuss their next move, I ducked under the railing and edged into position. I purposely didn't look down again. One of the goons took a step toward me. "What do you think you're doing? You nuts?" he asked. They were getting ready to rush me, I could tell. "Move away from there," ordered the other bouncer, also moving forward. "You're gonna break your fool neck." "I wasn't planning on it," I said. Something like panic showed in their pudgy, squinting faces. They figured they'd lose their jobs, or worse, if they let something bad happen to me. One of the men whipped out a walkie-talkie and held it close to his mouth. "Luno, better come check this out." "Yeah, tell him to hurry," the other man said. "This kid's a real space case." It was definitely time to go. The bouncers reached out and lunged, but I was already in the air, falling sweetly to freedom. Or so I told myself as I hollered, "Geronimo!" I don't remember hitting the water, but I do remember sinking. Not very deep, but deep enough to remind me that I was wearing Abby's backpack. I could have ditched it, but that would have been the same as littering. Besides, Miss Abby Underwood was written with a bright red marker in two different places on the backpack. If somebody found it and saw all those empty food coloring bottles, we were busted for sure. Hurriedly, I loosened one strap of the backpack to free my right shoulder, which made it easier to swim. I wasn't breaking any Olympic records, but I was definitely putting some distance between myself and the Coral Queen. At any moment, I expected the blue dinghy to come chugging into view, Abby riding to the rescue. Behind me, where the casino boat was moored, a shouting match had erupted. I turned my head and spotted Luno stomping back and forth under the dock lights, hollering furiously at the two bouncers on the top deck. The bouncers were yelling back, pointing across the basin. Pointing at me, of course. I kicked harder, thinking, "Hurry up, Abby. Hurry."
"Stop, boy,"
Luno commanded.
"You stop now."
He was running along the docks, trying to keep even with me, so I dove beneath the surface. The dirty water stung my eyes, and I squeezed them shut. It didn't matter, because even with my eyes wide open, I couldn't have seen a whale 3 inches in front of my nose, not in that murky basin in the dead of night. I was swimming blind, but at least I was swimming. When I came up for air, a white blast of light caught me squarely in the face.
"There he is,"
Luno cried out. He was standing on a fish-cleaning table, sweeping a portable spotlight across the basin. I ducked like a turtle and swam farther. When I popped up again, the same thing happened. The bright light, Luno yelling at me to stop. This time, though, he sounded closer. Where was my sister? The channel was at least 100 yards away. Luno would run out of dock before I'd run out of water. But I was getting exhausted. My clothes were slowing me down, and the waterlogged backpack felt heavier by the minute. Still, no sign of the dinghy. Even if my Geronimo wasn't loud enough, Abby surely must have heard Dusty Muleman's goons bellowing like bull elephants. I took a gulp of air and dove under again. Two kicks later, I struck what seemed to be a wall of blubber. A wall that moved. Next thing I remember was me spinning like a top, then shooting upward, launched by some invisible brute force. Flying out of the water, I opened my eyes just in time to see an enormous brown shape, mossy and slick, pushing away at an incredible speed. A broad, rounded tail slapped the surface so hard it sounded like a rifle. Right away, I knew what had happened. I'd crashed into a sleeping manatee. I splashed down in a tumble. For a solid minute, I treaded water, not going anywhere, until my heart quit racing and I was able to catch my breath. The marina was momentarily quiet, except for the merry chime of steel drums from the Coral Queen's Calypso band. Where in the world was Abby, and where was that caveman Luno? I began swimming again, although not as bravely as before. The collision with the sea cow had rattled me. I couldn't help wondering what other creatures might be cruising around the dark, cloudy basin. As huge as manatees are, they feed strictly on vegetation and have no appetite for humans. That's not true for everything that swims at night, especially certain large and fearless sharks. The water was as warm as soup, but an icy shiver ran down my neck as I kicked onward. I only know a few prayers by heart, but I said all of them to myself. Twice. That's how scared I was. I can't say for certain whether God was listening, but it wasn't long afterward that I heard the wheezy chug-a-chug-chug of a small outboard motor. I stopped moving and fixed my eyes in the direction of the noise. A familiar shape took form along the edge of the shadows, near the mouth of the basin. As the shape drew closer into the pale wash of the dock lights, I recognized the blue dinghy and the spindly silhouette of my sister at the helm. Excitedly, I called Abby's name, and she responded with our prearranged signal, 3 rapid blinks of her flashlight. I set out for the little boat as fast as I could, not caring how much noise I made. All I wanted was to get out of the water in one piece. Abby whistled, but I was too exhausted to whistle back. The dinghy was no longer heading my way. In fact, it seemed to be sliding away in the current. By the time I caught up, my arms and legs were starting to cramp. I grabbed onto the bow and, with my sister's help, hauled myself aboard. At first, I couldn't even talk. I just sat there, dripping and panting like a tired old dog. Finally, I shook off the backpack and dried my face with the tail of Abby's shirt. "You okay?" she asked. I nodded and rubbed my aching muscles. "How come you turned off the engine?" "I didn't," Abby said. "It stalled out." "Nice. That's how come I was late getting here. It took like forever to get the stupid thing started." I stepped to the stern to confront the creaky old Evinrude. The starter cord was 3-foot length of rope that wrapped tightly around the engine's flywheel. A small block of plastic served as a handle on the exposed end of the rope, so you could pull it without shredding your fingers. Hand cranking an outboard is harder than starting a lawnmower. Marine engines have more horsepower, so it takes more strength to turn the flywheel. After bracing my heels against the transom of the dinghy, I locked both hands against the grip of the starter cord. "Do it," said my sister. "Keep your fingers crossed." I reared back and yanked. The engine shuddered, coughed once, then went silent. "Crap," mumbled Abby. "Don't worry," I said, which was ridiculous. Only an idiot wouldn't have been worried. I shifted my weight slightly and took hold of the rope again. "Let it happen, Cap'n," said Abby. At that instant, the dinghy lit up like a movie stage. Luno had found us with his spotlight. Abby and I shielded our eyes and tried to see where he was. His voice gave us the answer. He was close. Too close.
"You again," we heard him snarl. "You 2 punks. This time you no get away."
He was standing at the end of the last dock in the marina. Off our port side was the mouth of the basin, and beyond that, open sea. If I could only get Rado's darn engine started, Abby and I could escape. Again, I tried the starter cord, and again, nothing happened but a sad sputter. "We're drifting toward the dock," my sister said, gloomily. "I can see that. Should we jump?" "No, not yet." 4, 5, 6 times I pulled the rope with the same depressing result. Meanwhile, a breeze was pushing the dinghy steadily toward the dock, where Luno was pacing like a hungry cat. For amusement, he would occasionally zap us with the hot beam of his spotlight. Abby crouched low in the bow, but I had to keep standing. It was the only way to put enough force into pulling the starter cord. As we floated closer to the lights, we could make out Luno's gloating expression.
His smile was thin and ugly. Frantically, I jerked on the starter cord, and this time the old engine gave an encouraging kick before sputtering out.
Luno crowed, "I get you punks now."
My sister poked me in the back. "Noah, look! Quick!" Another figure had joined the bald goon at the end of the dock. I recognized him immediately in that flowered Hawaiian shirt, but just the stink from his cigar would have given him away. It was Dusty Muehlman himself. "I'm out of here," said Abby, poised to jump. "No, wait!" I feverishly resumed hauling on the starter cord, one hard pull after another. Nothing makes you forget how tired you are like pure, cold fear. I was working like a robot in high gear. Then my sister cried, "Noah, duck!" And ducking would have been a smart move, no doubt about it, because I turned to see Luno with his meaty right arm extended, aiming a stubby-looking gun at the dinghy. Dusty stood off to the side, blowing lazy rings of blue smoke. The scene was so unreal, I just froze. It was like watching someone else's nightmare. I felt blank and numb and far away.
"What's the matter with you? Get down!" Abby yelled.
But now we've drifted to within 50 feet of the dock, which made us an easy target. Finally, an alarm bell went off in my brain, and I threw up both arms, shouting, "Don't shoot! We give up!" Dusty chuckled quietly. Luno was leering like a psycho. He did not lower the gun barrel even 1 millimeter.
"You kids make bad mistake," he said. "Now must pay."
If ever I was going to wet my pants in public, it would have been right then and there. Yet all I could think about was protecting my sister, so I threw myself on top of her. The landing wasn't so graceful. I banged my chin on the gunwale and nearly capsized us. Wrapping my arms around Abby, I waited for the explosion of a gunshot. It never came. A fierce and breathless struggle had broken out on the dock. Peeking over one side of the dinghy, Abby and I witnessed an amazing sight. As if dropped from the stars, a third man had materialized under the dock lights, and he was pounding Luno into a sweaty lump of jello. The only sign of Dusty Muehlman was the slapping of his designer flip-flops against the ground as he scurried off in terror toward the Coral Queen. The cheerful tinkle of steel drums now mixed with Luno's odd, piggish grunts, the wiry stranger swinging a deck mop with painful accuracy. In fact, he wasn't a total stranger to me and my sister. We were near enough to see the M-shaped scar on his weathered tan face and the bright gold coin swinging from the chain around his neck.
"The pirate guy," Abby whispered gleefully. "Outrageous!"
"Don't you move," I told her, and clambered to the stern. I seized the handle of the starter rope and from a squatting position yanked with every ounce of muscle I had left. By some small miracle, the rickety old engine purred to life. I whipped the dinghy around, aimed it toward the channel, and twisted the throttle wide open. I glanced back, just as the mysterious pirate was hurling Luno's stubby gun into the basin. For an old geezer, he had a pretty good arm. After reaching the open water, I slowed to half speed. Running a boat at night is tricky because you can't see very far or very clearly, and a cheapo flashlight doesn't help much. All kinds of hazardous clutter could be floating in your path. Boards, driftwood, coconuts, ropes, and it wouldn't have taken much to wreck the propeller blades on the old Evinrude. Abby perched on the bow, watching out for obstacles, while I tried to navigate by the lights of the shoreline. Motels, mansions, RV parks, tiki bars. The darkest stretch was Thunder Beach, peaceful and deserted under a yellow moon. An ideal night for a mama turtle to crawl up and lay her eggs, I thought. The salt air felt good on our faces as we ran against a light chop. Above us hung a glittering spray of stars that stretched all the way to Cuba. I was happier than I'd ever been, and so was Abby. "We did it," she cheered. "We are so hot." "Adios, Captain Muehlman," I shouted with a phony salute. The hardest part of Operation Royal Flush was over. We'd laid the trap and escaped, though barely. Being chased by Luno wasn't part of the plan, but it didn't spoil anything. For now, Dusty Muehlman and his gorillas wouldn't be able to figure out what I'd been doing aboard the Coral Queen, since the only clue had gone down the toilets. Way, way down the toilets, into the holding tank, the last place they'd ever stick their heads. Only later would Dusty realize what I'd done, and by then he'd have worse problems, namely the U.S. Coast Guard, which I intended to call first thing in the morning. But as jazzed as I was, I couldn't forget how close Abby and I came to being shot. Shot. It was unbelievable. Why, I wondered, would Dusty stand there and let Luno take aim at a couple of pint-sized trespassers? We must have really annoyed him, I thought, with all our snooping around. And what were the odds of being rescued for a second time by the same stranger? Either the old pirate was following us around like some sort of weird guardian angel, or Abby and I were the luckiest two kids in Florida. Hard right, she called from the bow. I pushed the tiller, and we skittered past a glistening spear of 2x4, only inches away. It would have punched a hole in the hull for sure. Good eyes, I called to my sister. Thanks. What's that noise? Don't know. Noah, why are you slowing us down? She shouted. I'm not, I said. Not on purpose, anyway. But the little boat was definitely losing speed. The loud noise that Abby and I had heard was the outboard engine throwing a piston rod, though we didn't know that at the time. The motor conked out with a sickly rattle. I knew we were in major trouble, but I went through the motions of removing the cowling and fiddling with the spark plug connections. It didn't fool Abby for a second. I don't suppose you brought Dad's toolbox, she said. Very funny. I tried to pull the starter cord, but it wouldn't budge. The old Evinrude was stone dead. A heavy, tired silence fell over us. Once again, the little boat was at the mercy of the breeze, which was taking us out to sea toward the Straits of Florida. Obviously, our good luck had run out. We're history, my sister said. Mom and Dad will go postal when they get home and we're not there. The wind was clocking around to the northwest. In summer, that usually means bad weather is on the way. I said, better toss the anchor. No, wait a second! Too late. My stomach clenched when I heard the splash. Let me guess, Abby said. The rope wasn't tied on, was it? My fault. I should have checked. So I just threw our anchor away. How nice, she sighed in discouragement. Now what? We saw a distant flash of electric blue, which was followed by a slow, deep rumble. 7 miles. Not good, Abby said. Dad had taught us how to count the seconds between the lightning bolt and thunder. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, to figure out how many miles away a storm was. Like Abby, I'd counted 7. Maybe it'll miss us, she said. Yeah, and maybe someday monkeys will fly helicopters, I thought. In a few short minutes, our mood had plunged from the highest high to the lowest low. The moon slipped behind a rolling gray carpet of clouds, and the freshening gusts smelled wet. Abby scrunched low in the bow while I hunkered between the seats. The lightning got brighter, and the thunder got louder. But all we could do was brace for it. Rado's dinghy had no oars, and we were already too far from shore to swim. Not that either of us was eager to jump in. I remembered Dad saying that you always stay with a boat as long as it's still floating, because a boat is easier than a body for searchers to find. Soon the wind began to hum, slapping us with sheets of cold rain. You all right? I asked my sister. Snug as a bug, she said. The little boat slopped across the crests of the waves, moving farther and farther from shore. Stabs of lightning turned the dark into daylight, and I'd catch brief glimpses of Abby covering her face with the backpack. I felt horrible for getting us into such a mess, and I was furious at myself for letting her come along. It was one of the all-time dumbest things I'd ever done. The wind-whipped raindrops stung our skin, and every thunderclap sounded like a bomb. As hard as I tried, I couldn't stop my knees from knocking against the hull. I didn't want Abby to know how frightened I was, or how much danger we were in. If a lightning bolt struck the dinghy, we'd be roasted like crickets on a radiator. I wiped off my wristwatch and checked the time. 1:40. Mom and Dad were home by now, probably going nuts trying to find us. I felt like throwing up. Hey, Noah, Abby said. What? My butt's underwater. Mine too, I said glumly. Shouldn't we, like, do something? Yeah, I guess. We spent the next 2 hours bailing the boat, which is a major pain when all you've got are empty food dye bottles that hold 1 measly ounce of liquid. Lucky for us, the storm blew through swiftly, the rain quit, and the dinghy didn't sink. No sooner had the stars come out again than I heard Abby snoring. I wasn't sure how far offshore we drifted, but I could still see the faint string of lights that marked the coastline. I stretched out on one of the seat planks, staring up at the moon, and wondering how long it would take for somebody to spot us. I was determined to remain awake in case a boat passed close by. Then I could signal for help with the flashlight. But my eyes didn't stay open very long. The next thing I remember was the sun warming my cheeks, a seagull squawking overhead.